So, vaccination ethics. Topic for today is risk versus reward, or really more aptly put, risk versus risk. The issue of exposing oneself to one danger in order to reduce a different and potentially greater danger. Other topics I want to talk about in the series are compelling risk-taking for the sake of the community. Is it okay for schools, for example, to require vaccination for its students to be able to attend? Volunteering for challenge trials in which somebody is actually given a vaccine and then given the disease. Well, there are different versions of trials, and some they're directly administered and some they're not. But I want to talk about taking extreme risks in order to save others. And of course, vaccine distribution, the issue of triage, who gets a vaccine first. In the era of COVID, COVID has sort of, sucked all the oxygen out of the room on vaccine conversations. But keep in mind, there are other vaccines in this world. There's the flu vaccine. Hopefully people are getting that. There's measles, mumps, rubella, and so on. And what we're going to say is not really COVID specific, although some of it has greater application during COVID. Special thanks to the following people who donated to my Beit Midrash back in our campaign in July to dedicate a class, and their dedications are for this class. Louise Goldberg, Dove and Jane Goldberg, and Danny and Ellen Gordon. So thank you to you. There's so much you can say about vaccines and about all of these issues that we're going to be discussing in this series, way more than you can actually fit into the 4 hours that we have. So I gave you a link at the top of the source sheet. And for those who just came in case you don't have the source sheet that I sent out in the email, again, I just put it in the chat. The top of the source sheet, I gave you a link for a class that I gave, this is, I think, 2016, on vaccines. And there we discussed in greater depth some of the issues that we're going to be talking about. You can download that the audio recording there to get a little bit more on vaccines. But here's my hypothetical question. This is an imaginary case, and I stress that it's an imaginary case. This is not real. It's in source number 2 on the sheet. I even underlined the word imaginary just in case there was any doubt. And here's our question. A vaccine is discovered for COVID-19. It provides immunity for 85% of recipients. It exacerbates heart murmurs in 3 people per million. Would you take the vaccine? Provides protection for 85% based on the studies that are done initially. However, it exacerbates heart murmurs in 3 people per million. Would you take the vaccine? What would you say? I see Brenda saying yes. Ian, you unmuted. What do you say?
Yes.
Ian says yes. No one's concerned about the potential harm. Phyllis, what do you say?
I say no. When you say exacerbates, does that mean if you have an existing condition that it makes it worse, or are you saying no, that it may bring on this new condition?
Right. So Dahlia says no. Phyllis asks, what do we mean by exacerbates? And since it's an imaginary case, we can say whatever we want. So I can offer you either one, and you tell me how you would feel about it in either case.
I wouldn't.
We get a wooden.
I would check with my cardiologist.
Ah, there's an intelligent answer. Ask the doctor.
I would say I probably would take it. If I had an pre-existing condition, I might not. And also, if I knew there was going to be a herd immunity, then I would rely on that. If there's going to be 85%, if there was going to be general take-up.
So that's another question, right? Maybe the risk goes down as other people are taking the vaccine. Also an interesting consideration. And there's no right answer to this. This is a question of what would you do, rather than what would Jewish law say or something, something more objective, assuming that Jewish law would provide you with a direct answer, which isn't so clear cut either. That's what we have to talk about. But this is the type of question that people have to ask, not just with a COVID vaccine, but with any vaccine. the question of what if there is a risk? What if there is a downside? And as we're going to note, even though I am absolutely, I want to be 100% clear here, I am in the pro-vaccine camp. I have read the anti-vaccine articles. I have read the studies which have made claims about autism links and so on. And yeah, I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor, but everything that I come away with is on the side of taking vaccines. I want to make sure that I say that up front and very clearly. Having said that, anytime you put something in your system, you're taking a risk. It's true with things you eat, and it's true with things you inject. So you have to keep that in mind. Yes, Rose.
You also have to be very aware to, you know, when you take a vaccine, it's not 100% successful.
Right.
And I think one has to consider that in your success rate, this is not a good vaccine. If it's got a 70% uptake, it's amazing. But like when you look at this, roughly a flu vaccine, for example, or let's take the COVID, it's a 50% success. So one also has to take that into consideration. It's not an all or none phenomenon, and one has to be
right. Absolutely. So take a look at number two. I think we read it right before you got on. But take a look at source number two. In my sample case, it's an 85%. In that particular case. So one thing to realize in this conversation is that vaccines were a major topic of controversy in Jewish communities before COVID. Again, COVID has just taken over everybody's focus. But even if you go back just a year or two, this was a major issue in Jewish communities regarding the measles vaccine. Now, I'm going to show you excerpts from certain articles, and I want to be really careful here. The goal in bringing these articles is not to vilify a particular sector of the Jewish community. It happens to be there is a sector of the Jewish community which had a disastrous vaccination rate for measles, and it led to very serious consequences. Take a look at source number three, please. This is an article from 2015 from Rabbi J. David Bleich. The article, aptly titled, Vaccination, from the journal Tradition. In 2013, a measles outbreak erupted in Borough Park and was traced to an unvaccinated youngster who contracted measles during a visit to England, and upon his return to this country, transmitted the disease to other unvaccinated family members. Other Borough Park residents became infected. The disease spread to Williamsburg as well. A total of 58 cases occurred in those neighborhoods, including a young woman who became afflicted with measles and suffered a miscarriage. Measles outbreaks occurred in Haredi areas of Jerusalem in 2001, 2004, 2007. A more recent outbreak involving 63 cases occurred in northern Israel in 2012. There were also 21 confirmed cases of whooping cough in Williamsburg and Borough Park between October 2014 and April 2015. Included in that number were 18 children, 3 adults. Among the children, 12 were entirely unvaccinated. 2 were incompletely immunized. 10 of the afflicted children were under 10 months of age, and 2 infants required hospitalization. In none of those cases had the mother received the recommended tetanus, diphtheria, acellular pertussis vaccination during pregnancy. So those are cases going back, as you see here, you know, in the last 10 to 20 years. But the truth of the matter is, as I said, even more recently, take a look at source number 4, a CNN article from April of 2019. New York City declares a public health emergency amid Brooklyn measles outbreak. The public health emergency comes in response to 285 cases of measles reported in Brooklyn and Queens since the beginning of the outbreak in October. The same outbreak is responsible for 15 cases of measles in Orange County, New York, 168 cases in Rockland County, New York. The outbreak began when, according to health officials, an unvaccinated child became infected with the illness while visiting Israel. Since then, there have been additional people from Brooklyn and Queens who were unvaccinated and acquired measles while in Israel. People who did not travel were also infected in Brooklyn and Rockland County. I could have brought you articles all day long on this phenomenon. There was a study by the Massachusetts Medical Society in which they looked at statistics for vaccination rates. What in the world is this about? Why is there such a refusal to vaccinate in a particular community? is there a basis in Judaism for, in fact, not vaccinating? Ian, you unmuted, or you were just unmuted from before?
From before.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to remute people just so I don't get confused. But this is a fundamental question. Why is it that some sectors will not vaccinate? Now, part of this is sociological, and I'm not addressing that right now. For example, Jewish communities have a very long history of not trusting government, and frankly, it saved many lives in various generations, not trusting what the government was trying to tell you. However, in our current era, in what we're dealing with right now, what was once a defense mechanism can end up being suicidal. And that's something to be cognizant of. But we're not talking about that issue. We're talking about from a perspective of halakha, from a perspective of Jewish law. Is there reason to not vaccinate? So this is not a new issue. When vaccines for smallpox were introduced in the end of the 18th century, there were Jews who said, we're not going to vaccinate. We don't want to put something dangerous into our system. There's a well-known, not really full book, but pamphlet called Ale Trufa about this issue. Take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Bleich, in his article on vaccination, quoted it. The earliest published reaction from within the Jewish community came in 1785. An otherwise unknown individual named Alexander ben Solomon Nanish of Hamburg, who had lost two of his own children to smallpox, published a work entitled Ale Trufa, translates to Leaf of Healing, in London, containing a response him discussing the halachic permissibility of inoculation against smallpox. He wanted people to vaccinate. He had lost children to smallpox, but the fact that he needed to promote vaccination tells you there were people who were refusing back then as well. So, as I said before, the most basic reason not to vaccinate is because there is going to be risk to anything. I brought you a piece in source number 6, not about vaccination, but about cosmetic surgery, just because I like the statistics that he brought. This is Dr. Arthur Perry. Straight talk about cosmetic surgery. He says the risk of dying in any surgical procedure is between 1 in 250,000 and 1 in 500,000. I have no idea, you know, how he reached those numbers, nor do I know if things have changed between 2007 and 2020. But he says those are the numbers. This is similar to the risk of dying in a plane crash. In contrast, the chance of being involved in a fatal car accident was estimated at 1 in 2,000 in a study of the California highway system, 1 in 5,000 nationwide, and then he goes on to talk about certain procedures being more risky than others. Now, you can argue his statistics, in particular the highway statistics, but the key thing to remember, and I'm sure all of you are aware of it, but I think it bears saying, is that even if it's 1 in 500,000, do you know how many people we're planning to vaccinate? Right? We're hoping to vaccinate billions of human beings. Right? 1 in 500,000? Well, if you vaccinate 1 million people, that means that you've got 2 people who are going to be harmed. He's talking there of dying. 2 people who are going to be killed by doing that. If you multiply that out and now you're at 1 billion people, that means you're killing 2,000 people. You have to be aware of that. These numbers sound really good when you say, well, 2 in 500,000, but recognize how many people we're doing this to. It's like when they say that, you're 1 in 1 million. Well, that means that in New York City, there are 11 people like you, right? Because you have 11 million people. So that's something that you have to be aware of. And it's true for vaccines as well, that there are risks. And, you know, I deliberately did not bring articles about genuine risks of vaccines here because, as I said in the beginning, I don't want to strengthen the positions of the anti-vaccine groups, many of which overblow or, frankly, in some of the things I've seen, falsify concerns about risks, and I really don't want to strengthen that. Give me 1 second, Mark. Having said that, again, there are risks. You can't deny that. And the technologies evolve. There are elements that were included in vaccines over time that were found to be dangerous, right? There are steps taken in order to make vaccines more effective that may well involve a risk. Example, the polio vaccine, and then I'll come to you, Mark. When they switched from the dead virus to the live virus, so it was important to switch to the live virus because that way you immunize not only the person receiving the vaccine, but also the people who are around them. But going to a live virus raised a risk of 2 to 4 in a million people of contracting polio. Well, society decides that's worth it, but you have to recognize there is indeed a risk. I'll give you one more example. There are certain chemicals that were used in vaccines when I was a kid that now they've taken out because they said, you know what, they pose a risk. Well, that's great, but well, what about me? You know, you gave me the vaccine. And you wonder, so what are they going to discover in the next 20 years? And they're going to say, well, yeah, we shouldn't have been doing that. We should be doing it differently. So you can't pretend there aren't risks involved. Yes, Mark?
Do you have a gut feeling of overlap between people, Jews, who are concerned about vaccines and Jews who are concerned about masks and social distancing?
Well, that goes back to my sociological point, right, about people not trusting government. And they absolutely... are in the same, they're in the same boat, yes. So yes, I definitely see such an overlap. Do you?
Absolutely, and I just hope it's a big boat.
What can I tell you? I hope it doesn't leak. So the question that we have to ask this morning is, knowing that there are risks, what does Judaism say about taking a low risk to avoid a more likely danger? So some of you were there when I did a series on bioethics a few Junes ago. It was June of, I don't know, 2017 or so, I think, and talked about the methodology that we use in Judaism to approach ethical issues. What you have to do is first figure out what your legal issues are, what your ethical issues are, like this question of taking one risk to avoid a different one. Then we go back to text. We look at the Chumash. We look at the text of the Torah. We look in Tanakh for basic laws, as well as sources that relate to ethical issues. Now, in order to do that well, you need to know Chumash. You need to know Tanakh. You need to know the text as part of figuring out what the questions even are, what the issues even are. We look at the rabbinic writings. How did they apply those biblical sources? And then you have to ask, okay, but the case in front of me, does it have anything unique, anything that's different about it that warrants special treatment? Because you can come up with general principles, but then recognize they don't apply to the case at hand. So we're going to try to use that mechanism here, starting from the biblical, working our way through the rabbinic, and asking, so how does this apply? What kind of guidance can it provide in our particular case? So, main issue number one. In Judaism, and you are likely familiar with this, we are obligated to avoid harm to ourselves and to others. Right? Basic principle. If you take a look on your sheet, and I'm going to put the link in the chat one more time for the source sheet, as well as make a plug. If anyone is not on the email list for the class, please do sign up. If you don't know how to sign up, email me. But take a look at source number 7, a verse from Leviticus, in which God says, "And guard my statutes and my law." Right? It should be laws. It should be plural. "Which one shall do and live by them." What's the Hebrew for "and live by them"? Anyone know? What's the Hebrew for this? V'chai bohem. Bingo. Thank you, Ruchama. I knew you were here somewhere. V'chai bohem. You shall live by them. This is a mandate that we are supposed to live by the mitzvot, and we're going to come back to that. A second source, and I could have brought a few others, but a second source here, source number 8. The Torah says, "V'nishmartem me'od lenafshoteichem." Me'od. You shall protect your lives greatly. We have a duty, biblically, to protect our lives. And the rabbis applied that. Most famously, they said that we override Shabbat in order to save lives. We override Yom Kippur in order to save lives. Right? There are a couple of laws in Judaism that we would not override. We will not allow you to kill somebody else in order to save your life. That's a no-go. But as a general principle, we override laws in order to save life. Take a look at source number 9. Passage from the Talmud implementing the verse from source number 7. Rav Yehuda quoted Shmuel saying, well, let me give you you're walking into the middle of a discussion. The Talmud wants to know there, how do you know that we override Shabbat, that we override Yom Kippur in order to save lives? And it brings a whole string of arguments, some of them logical, some of them based on verses. And each one, they say, yeah, but you could argue against this, you could argue against that, until you get source number 9. Rav Yehuda quoted the sage Shmuel with the winning argument. Had I been there when they were having this discussion, he says, I would have said, my source is better than theirs. What's his source? Vayikra, Leviticus 18:5. It says, you shall live by them and not die by them. And Rava, the sage Rava, said there are refutations for all of them other than that of Shmuel. That position is ironclad. The Torah says you're supposed to live by the mitzvot, but saving a life will override these mitzvot. I brought you a fun source in source number 10. I liked this source. Also a passage in the Talmud. A father and son who are both sages. But the father has something to say to the son. He has something to teach his son here. Rav Huna said to his son, Rabba, why are you not learning before Rav Chisda, whose lessons are sharp? You stopped going to Rav Chisda's classes. Now, for those who are Talmudically familiar, you may know, Rav Huna and Rav Chisda are sparring partners. They debate with each other. But Rav Huna says to his son, Rabba, you know, Rav Chisda's really sharp. Why'd you stop going to class? Rabba replied, why should I go to him? He questions me about mundane matters. He tells me one who goes to the washroom should not sit immediately or press door. He's giving me advice about, you know, hygiene in the bathroom and like, that's not, I'm there because I want to know the laws. I'm not there because I want advice like that. Rav Huna replied, he is involved in human life and you say mundane matters? You certainly should go to him. He says, you need to know hygiene. You need to know health. These are really important things. Don't play it down. It's important that he learn and teach medical issues. So that's a perspective which emphasizes looking after your health.
Where is it written, nefesh bria beguf bari?
I don't know.
I remember this from somewhere and I don't remember from where.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like a nice aphorism. For those who didn't catch it, it's a healthy soul in a healthy body. But honestly, I'm not familiar with the source for that.
Oh,
yeah, Sarah, you have?
Is that what the Greek philosophy was?
That could be.
That's why they had the gymnasium and everything?
Could be. Could be. It's very interesting.
That's what I know.
There's a lot to be said about the relationship between Judaism and Hellenism and where we parted ways on issues like the body. There's a lot to be said about that. But yeah, it could be, but again, I just don't know. Marilyn, you were going to say?
Well, I can't help but analogize with war and military. When we go to war, we know that there are going to be lives lost. I would associate that. There's always a risk. They have to weigh the risk and the percentage.
Right. So you're making an important point, but I'm not ready for it yet. Marilyn is already applying this to community and the issue of risks within the community, and we do have to go there. But we have a few steps that we have to get to first. We're still dealing with the individual. I have an obligation to avoid harm for myself. However, let's apply this now to that. Yes, Susan.
Somewhere, I may be wrong, but I remember learning somewhere that if you're in the desert
and you only have water for yourself, but there's somebody else, rather than both of you dying, you save yourself?
Yeah, the Talmud says that you would be the one to drink the water. If you only have enough water for one person, and you know that if you share it, then you're not going to survive and they're not going to survive, and if you give it all to them, then they will, but you won't, then yes, that's the technical ruling. Interesting. Dr. Kirshen, thank you very much. He brings you from Rav Kook in Arod HaTshuva, which I'm embarrassed about because I knew Arod HaTshuva really well at one point. But he says, Nishama bria beguf bari muchrachati lavo lidei haosher hagadol shel tshuva. He says, a healthy soul in a healthy body is necessary in order to reach the great fulfillment or satisfaction of repentance. And he says the source for that quote is from a Roman. It's from a Roman who is called in Hebrew. They write his name as Yuvnalis. I wonder what that Yuvnalis. I'm not sure that. Oh, Juvenilis. Right. Okay. Fine. They took me a minute to break that down into the Hebrew. But the idea in and of itself, the idea of the healthy soul and the healthy body, is one that the Rambam talks about in the sense that the Rambam says you can't serve God when you're ill. Like, there's a lot to be said about the concept. But thank you, Dr. Kirshen, for bringing us Rav Kook with the direct quote that Ruchama mentioned. So the problem here is, the challenge here is, in as much as we're saying that you're supposed to avoid harm to yourself, and therefore I might think you should take risks for it, we're going to come back to that, keep something in mind. Let's pretend for the moment that vaccines had no risk. Okay? Let's pretend for the moment that you knew, I can take the vaccine and there's absolutely no harm whatsoever that's going to come my way. Would you then be obligated to take a vaccine?
Yes, if you can prevent illness. Yes.
Are you sure? What's the argument against? Okay. So I'm going to give you an argument against in a little bit. But for now, I'm going to support you. So for now, we're on the same team. The Torah does indeed say that not only are we supposed to preserve our lives, so get medical treatment if you need it, but we are also supposed to avoid dangerous situations in the first place. We have a biblical prohibition. Take a look, please, at source number 13. And then I'm going to come back to number 11. But first, let's see number 13. When you build a new house, a verse in Deuteronomy, when you build a new house, make a ma'akeh for your roof. Anybody know what a ma'akeh is?
Yes, a fence.
Right. It's a low fence. You're supposed to make sure that if you have an area in your house that people can walk on that has a drop-off, you have to put a fence around it. So if you have a roof that people are able to walk on, you have a responsibility to fence it in. If you have a landing in your house, you know, at the top of the stairs, and there's a drop-off, you have to make sure that it's fenced in. This is building code 101 from the Torah. The verse continues, do not put blood in your home should one who falls fall from it, right? You would be responsible if somebody were, God forbid, to fall. Based on that, take a look at source number 11, passage in the Talmud. Rabbi Natan said, how do you know that one may not raise a bad dog in his home? Bad, obviously dangerous. One may not set up a weakened ladder in his home. That verse, you shall not place blood in your home. Interestingly, you might say, okay, so I can keep a dangerous dog. I just have to put up a beware of dog sign. Right? Just warn people. That's all. So Ian is shaking his head no. He's got the condo association board hat on. He says that's not going to be enough. What do you say, Ian?
You have a lot of legal liability if you don't manage things thoroughly.
Yes.
So, yeah. And the one thing that we
Right.
Even if it's 85 or 50 or 100% of a situation, they have mathematics that, or they use mathematics, they use it to develop this.
Right.
Also, our boards of government, like the workman's compensation, uses that to determine what you really need, or they will charge you if you don't properly set up protection so there is no blood.
Right. So I'm going to go back just to the dog case, saying there's a lot more in what you're saying and worthy of discussion, I think, at another time. But take a look at number 12. Rabbi Menashe Klein was asked about beware of dog signs. And look at his response. He quotes you the passage in the Talmud that we brought in source number 11 about raising a bad dog. And he says, from that passage in Bava Kamma in the Talmud, where Rabbi Natan said, we would excommunicate an owner of a hazard until he would remove the hazard, it seems there is no remedy other than removal of the hazard. That's what we actually require. Making a sign is insufficient. This is also seen in Maimonides' statement that one must fully remedy a ladder, if you have a bad ladder, or if there's a pit. He didn't write that a written warning would suffice. You can keep a ladder and just put a sign on it saying, you know, use at your own peril. This indicates that one must actually remove the danger such that no one will be harmed. However, some other action which would prevent harm would suffice. You don't necessarily have to throw it out, such as making a fence around the ladder so that people can't get to it. If there's something hazardous, you have to take a serious step to avoid it. This is what we call in Hebrew a lo ta'aseh, that you're not allowed to have a hazard around. Mark, I see you, but just hang on for a minute. There's also, along with it, that same verse that we read, an aseh. You have a commandment of remedy any problems. You have to do something to make sure to that you act to prevent problems proactively. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. Mark, you were going to say?
It's a much different danger. But we can't have bad weights and measures in our house and have a sign that these are bad. We just can't even possess them.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's exactly right. I'm not allowed to have something which could cause harm, even if I say, oh, I'm not going to use it and all of that, unless I take a measure that actually prevents people from using it. So I want to show you how far this goes. Take a look at source number 14, Maimonides. He says, there is a commandment to remove any stumbling block which endangers lives, and to guard from it, and to be very careful with this. As Deuteronomy says, we've already mentioned it. Actually, no, we didn't. He quotes you a verse, guard yourself and guard your life. The verse he quotes is actually a little controversial. There's some debate as to why he quotes this verse, but I'm not going to go into that right now. And if one does not remove the danger, and one leaves dangerous stumbling blocks, he fails to fulfill a commandment, and he violates, do not place blood. And the sages prohibited many activities because they endanger lives. Regarding anyone who transgresses and who says, I will endanger myself, what business is it of others, right? What do you care? If someone says that, or I don't care, we issue lashes of rebellion for him. He says, we are not interested in allowing people to risk their lives. You're not allowed to do it. That's how far Maimonides goes with his comment. You're not free to say, I am not concerned about it. Modern application of this, the issue of genetic screening. The idea of a couple getting screening, Sarah, I'll come to you in a minute. The idea of getting screening before having children, before marrying, really. Take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writing in 1973 regarding Tay-Sachs screening in the early stages of its adoption. He says, since it is easy to check, one should realize that failure to check oneself would be like closing one's eyes before that which one could see. God forbid such an event, meaning having the child, would cause the child's parents extraordinary pain, and so it will be appropriate for a man who wished to wed a woman, as was the case he was asked about, to test himself. make sure that you find out whether you are a carrier for this. And there are lots of ways in which testing is done. Different communities do it differently. Some take greater steps to preserve the anonymity of the people involved. But Rabbi Feinstein is saying, don't say, well, aren't you supposed to just put your faith in God? That's not the approach that he's willing to sanction. He says, you wouldn't step into traffic with your eyes closed. So too here, you have to take basic, achievable steps in order to protect your life. Sarah and then Susan.
Would that apply to the Israeli technique or warning system where Israelis, when they bombard villages, they have to retaliate? They warn the population, they send flyers.
So that's really a separate point. It's a valuable thing to do, for sure, but it's really a separate, I wouldn't mix that into this.
Okay.
Right now we're talking about protecting your own life. Before we talk about protecting the lives of others, there's this other issue of avoiding harm to other people, which we're gonna move into probably next week, when we talk about the issue of forcing vaccination in order to protect the community at large. We're gonna talk about that. That'll be a discussion then. Susan, you were gonna say?
I'm going to ask, and you may say it's off.
Okay.
You find that you're tested.
Yeah.
Then what's, and you have Pesach. I know somebody who lost 3 children at Pesach. What do? You don't have children, you abort. I mean, what's...
Oh, that is a very, very, very good question. It is way off topic. But it's a very good question. The way that I would frame it is to add a dimension of complication, which is the Torah has a mitzvah of attempting to have children, right? The mitzvah is not to succeed. The mitzvah is to try, to attempt to procreate. But what happens if a person has a genetically transmittable disease and you're talking about one like Tay-Sachs, you're not talking about a condition people can deal with. So do they still have an obligation to try to procreate? So this is a great conversation for another time. You know what? Maybe I'm going to send a link out to an article about it because it really is a good discussion. It's just not for right now.
I just wanted to know what the next step is.
Yeah. No, and it's a good question. It's just not for right now. So what we've established thus far, right, in our first 40 minutes here, is that number one, vaccines have been a major issue of controversy within Jewish communities historically, including recent history. We do have to acknowledge that there is an element of risk in a vaccine, as well as the possibility that the vaccine will not be 100% successful, as seen in source number 2 in the case that I gave. Our approach is to start with biblical text. Well, our approach is first to identify the question, then identify the biblical text that addresses it, move forward into rabbinic applications, and then ask, well, are there elements that are unique to this case? So our principal ethical issue that we have identified here is the question of entering into risk in order to avoid a different risk. And what we've established so far is I have an obligation to avoid harm for myself, both in terms of not entering into a dangerous situation and in terms of taking steps to avoid harm, like in the case of genetic screening. But now let's go the other way. What about engaging in a risky behavior to avoid other dangers? Tell me something. Do you think people should take risks in order to avoid other risks? Leave out vaccine, in principle. Yes, Sarah. So we're going to have to get to the question of how you evaluate and choose which risk to take. But my question first in principle, does it make sense to enter into risk in order to avoid other risks? The answer is, of course, yes. We do it all the time. We do it all the time.
Leaving your house, going into traffic and not being sedentary at home.
Yes, going out of the house. Rose, you were going to say?
It's like, for example, if you have a mammogram, simple, and there is a risk of the radiation,
mm-hmm.
but the risk of the mammogram being positive way outweighs the risk of the radiation. So it's just what takes precedence.
Right. Well, the real risk there is that one doesn't take the mammogram. Right. In other words.
Well, that's the real risk. But I'm saying if you do it, yes, it's a risk.
Yes.
Right. For that.
So take a look at source number 16, please. I'm going to frame it in the most basic level. The issue of getting a job. Right? You go to work. There is risk involved, and this is what Mark is talking about, leaving the house. There's risk involved in going to work. Even if you work from home, there's risk involved. That doesn't preclude dangers. But there's a biblical verse which speaks of the imperative to pay our employees on time. And it says, if you don't, the worker is going to cry out against you to God because he relies on this payment. And the verse says, "Ve'elav hu noseyes nafsho." He puts his life on the line, is the way that the Talmud reads that verse. He puts his life on the line for the sake of the salary. And the Talmud builds on that. Look at number 16. For this he puts his life on the line. Why did this person climb the ramp, become suspended from the tree, and give his life over to death? Why did he put himself in danger? Was it not for his wages? Wasn't it in order to be able to earn a living? Somebody takes a job in construction and goes up on tall buildings in order to build it, right? In order to do that, he's taking a risk. But the very fact that the Talmud recognizes that people take risks in order to earn a living says that I guess you're allowed to take risks in order to earn a living. There's another passage in the Talmud which talks about the concern for circumcision or bloodletting on a cloudy day. Why cloudy days would have been worse? Maybe because the person doing the bloodletting or the circumcision can't see well. Unclear. But what the issue is isn't as important as the phenomenon they're identifying. They're saying, we really would rather not do a circumcision on a cloudy day or a day when the south wind is blowing, but now everybody does it. When the masses trample this, when they all do it, so we quote the verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, hang on, Dahlia. Shomer psayim Hashem, God guards the fools. People do things, they do things. And therefore, it's okay. The way you know that it's an okay thing to do, to take risks for a particular purpose, and we have to talk about how you calculate it, but the way you know that you're able to do it is by looking at one of the blessings that you traditionally hear recited in the synagogue on a Shabbat morning. One of the classic blessings that is said, usually you hear it at the time of Torah reading, it's called Birkat HaGomel. What is Birkat HaGomel? Not Bar Shepetarani. That's a different one, Albert.
After you've had an accident or an incident, you dub
it. So Marilyn says, it's a blessing that is said after an accident. So the truth of the matter is that Birkat HaGomel is a blessing in which one thanks God for saving them from potential harm, right? And it's true that people say it after an event that they couldn't have avoided. So they'll say it after they were in an accident, as an example. However, people also say it after taking a trip that was considered to be dangerous. After a long boat journey, after a plane flight over water, there are all sorts of circumstances in which you say, thank you, God, for saving me from harm. But who licensed you to put yourself in a harmful situation in the first place? If you thought that it was dangerous to take the journey, then stay home. Answer, there are justifications for entering into a level of risk. Someone sent me a message in the chat privately asking, how do we deal with a case of taking an experimental drug therapy? And part of that will depend on what the other options are. But this is exactly the question that we're weighing here. It is recognized that you're able to take risks. The fact that there is a Birkat HaGomel testifies to that. The fact that people earn a living testifies to that. But the question then is, how do you determine which risk to take? So we have established that you're going to take risks, but how do you know which risk to take? What is Judaism going to say? So here, I'm going to offer three factors to consider. Factor number one, is one of the risks very low? are we talking about a situation in which, you know, you're going to take a boat, but the truth is after cruises and COVID, I should probably not give that example. But you're going to take a plane flight, and you know that statistically, planes do okay, thank God. We hear about the horrible cases, but generally speaking, they say that, that it's relatively safe. So am I able to say, well, the risk of the plane flight is low compared to the risk of my relatives being angry that I didn't come to the wedding. So not going to the wedding, high risk. Taking the plane flight, low risk. I guess I'll take the plane flight. Yes, Sandy, you were going to ask? No, you're pointing to something else. Okay. So that's one.
This is why I said Tfilat HaDerech, even if I go in for 3 blocks, you never know what's going to be.
Right. So, this is true. This is
Rabbi,
true. Yes.
I think you answered my question already.
Okay.
When you talk about going to work, it's only you at that point who's taking the risk, not your family. But to take a vaccination, yes or no, you are not with, like, the community.
Right. So we're going, right. We're going there, but that's going to be part of the next week discussion about community and individual. We're not there yet. Sandy, okay. And then we're going to go further here. Yeah. Okay, right. There are nuances to cases, and COVID changes everything. So that's one possible argument, is evaluate which risk is greater, which risk is lower, and go on that basis. There's another way to look at it, which I think all of you intuit, but we're going to provide some sources on it, which is cost-benefit. What's the projected cost of not taking one of the risks? It's not only about which side has a greater risk, right? If I don't go to work, what are the odds of me starving versus if I go to work and I take certain risks? But frame it as cost benefit. What's the cost of not taking one of the risks? And then a third approach, are both risks present in the moment, right now? Is one a present risk and the other a future risk? Let's look at sources on all of these. The first argument is, just say, which side has the greater risk? If it's a really low risk on this side, I am not so concerned. And this is a position taken by Rabbi Chaim Odzer, who was a leading authority in Jewish law in Poland pre-war. And source number 18, he's dealing with the issue of pregnancy. The question is this. We consider childbirth a dangerous activity. I say this looking at the screen in front of me, and, you know, almost all of the people looking back at me are women. We consider childbirth to be a risky thing for somebody to do, and indeed there's a Birkat HaGomel that is said after producing children. So maybe the argument should also after raising them, but maybe the argument should be that it's the dangerous thing to do. You don't have the right to intentionally conceive. Maybe you're not supposed to do that. I realize that would change the way the world would look. But take a look at source number 18. Rabbi Chaim Odzer dealt with this. He said, one must conclude that conception is very unlikely to be a concern, a rare minority of cases, and the sages weren't concerned for this. For this, one may rely upon God guards the fools. He's actually not dealing with normal pregnancy. I'm sorry. He was dealing with something else, which I forgot. But the message that he gives overall is that the principle that God guards people who are foolish, which was invoked in source number 17 regarding circumcision on a cloudy day, he says, when the risk you're talking about is a low risk, you're able to say, everybody does it, I'm going to do it too, and I'm going to be fine. That's the argument that he gives. He's dealing with a different case. It's not quite the way I'd framed it. But that's his basic statement. I don't have a duty to stay away from that kind of risk. That's one approach. Second approach. I'm sorry, before I get there. Within that, how low is very low risk? In other words, it's all well and good to say if it's really low risk, we can discount it.
It depends on the individual, what the risk is to you, what your background is, what the situation is.
What do you mean?
Weigh the odds.
No, I'm not. If you tell me that driving on Bathurst Street,
that's right, risky.
There you go. If you tell me that driving on Bathurst Street involves a risk of 1 in 100,000, okay? I'm just making up that number, okay? And then you tell me that the day after they switch the clock, that risk changes from 1 in 100,000 and now it's 1 in 90,000. So now do I have to lay off of Bathurst? What's the number? Where's your magic number?
But then you have to think about the time. It's darker in the morning, more people are hit. So you have to think of all of it. There's a reason for that.
So I need a number. I need some way to work with this. The problem is that Marilyn's instinct is halachically correct, meaning you can't work with formal numbers. That's not the way this works. Rabbi Usher Weiss, who is a leading authority in Jewish law in Israel today, is fond of saying that our sages did not deal in statistics. You know, we like to attach statistics to things. We analyze everything, and especially in the age of big data. We're going to crunch everybody's data and come out with numbers. But that's not really the way life has worked historically. That's not how it goes. So what defines risky? If people consider it risky. Ask people, would you do this or would you consider this dangerous? Take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, writing regarding the issue of vaccination specifically, talks about this this point. He invokes a word called, the word is sakana. Sakana means danger. And he says, one can see from this that Minchat Shlomo, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was a major authority in Jewish law in Israel till he passed away about 15 years ago, he says, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach is of the opinion that if most people assume that not being vaccinated is a sakana, is dangerous, if we assume that it's dangerous to go unvaccinated, then although the possibility of danger is quite remote, you'll say, well, it's a low percentage. In specific situations, it will be permitted to desecrate the Sabbath in order to be vaccinated. And surely someone must obtain vaccination on a weekday, since the public considers not vaccinating to be a danger, albeit a remote danger. What he's trying to tell you is, he's addressing the question of, what if the only time you can get a vaccine is Shabbos? That's your only opportunity. So what do you do? And he says, if we consider it dangerous to be unvaccinated, even if it's a low danger, then that's when you go. That's the statement that he's making. Now, thank God we live in a society where this isn't such an issue, where there are other days besides Saturday to be able to get a vaccine. A person would not be entitled under this to say, yeah, well, it's available on Friday, but honestly, Friday's a hard day for me. I'd like to go to work. So therefore, I'm going to go on Saturday. No, that's not okay. If it's a danger, it's a danger on Friday. But the point that he's making is you go by popular perception. And we have similar sources that are like that. So that's one way to calculate it, is ask, where is the, is one of the risks a very low risk? That's one way to view it. A second way to do it is cost benefit. What's the projected cost if I ignore one of the risks? Then what? Like, if I decide I'm not going to go to work because work is dangerous, well, then there's a risk of starvation. So it's a cost-benefit analysis. Take a look at source number 21. Rabbi Aryeh Lipschitz, writing in Lithuania, said about 150 years ago, talking about traveling the sea, taking trips. He says, to go to sea in the Mediterranean, meaning to wander the world and see new things, it will be appropriate to avoid this, but only to go for livelihood or trade. He says, where I am, at this point in history, it's a dangerous thing to do. If you're going for livelihood, for trade, then I get it. Because the risk if you don't go is starvation. However, to go just for a lark, that he's not willing to accept, right? And this is one of those things that comes up in the lockdown calculations, right? It's a cost-benefit analysis. What happens if we tell people they can go to work? What happens if we tell people they can go visit family? What happens if we tell people they can eat outdoors or indoors in a restaurant, right? I see your hand, Ian. What if I allow those things? What's the harm potentially on the other side? What's the level of risk on each side of the equation? So that's a second factor that we need to take into consideration. What I'm going to do now is, because I see it's 10:58, is I'm going to pause before the third factor and just come back to it for next week. But I want to do a summary and look at the review questions, and then I'll take questions and I'll stay late for that conversation. But I want to make sure that we deal with the summary to make sure that we understand what we said. And yes, Rose, that's correct in terms of your note in the chat that his brother, Maimonides' brother, passed away on a boat. So to summarize, we are required to take steps to protect our health. That includes not entering dangerous situations. That's on the one side. On the other hand, we are entitled to take risks in order to forestall other risks, as seen in the case of earning a living. And the way that we make the calculation is by asking, so far, number one, we ask the question of, is one of these risks very low? And number two, what's the projected cost if you ignore one of the risks? We still have to deal with a third factor, but look at the review questions. The two biblical verses that mandate avoiding harm to ourselves that we quoted are, you shall live by them, right? Live by them and not die by them. That was what we saw in source number 7. And you shall protect your lives greatly, which we saw in source number 8. The Talmud demonstrates the importance of avoiding harm to ourselves by talking about overriding Shabbat and overriding Yom Kippur in order to save lives. We know the mandate to protect our lives includes protection from future harm as seen regarding the ma'akeh, the wall that you have to build in your house around a drop-off, as well as the issue of not keeping a dangerous dog. What modern medical technology do Rabbi Feinstein require using for protection from harm? That was the genetic screening. People do every day to demonstrating that you're allowed to take one risk, a low risk, to avoid another one that's going to work. And then the three factors, which we've done two of, and we'll do the third, God willing, next time. So I'm going to stick around for questions and discussion. Again, if you didn't register yet, please do. You'll get on the email list that way. If you don't know how to register, you can email me. I'm also going to put it here in the chat. It's torontotorah.com/vaccine. And I will stay on now for further questions and comments. So thank you very, very much, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Yes, Ian. Ian and then Doreen.
Okay. First thing, I'm not a